author of Forging Genius, as well as columnist for Baseball Prospectus, the Yes Network, and the New York Sun. Hi, Steve. How are you doing today?
I'm good.
Good. Welcome to our debut radio show here, as it were.
Thank you. I'm honored.
I'm honored to have you on here. First of all, I wanted to talk a little bit about Forging Genius, more or less the genesis of this project. Why Casey Stengel?
There are so many reasons why. I mean, first of all, he was just a fascinating guy in that he invented himself. He was brilliantly funny. He had a unique way of speaking. He was a pioneer at managing, but in terms of the tactics that he used and the way he approached the game. More than that, though, I just got really curious about how this guy who won so many pennants and so many World Series could be dismissed so often, particularly by some players who played for him. Phil Rizzuto, for example, was one of the loudest anti-Stengel guys, and would say things like, "Those Yankee teams were so good that you or I could have managed them and gone away for the summer and still won the pennant." Seemed to me, looking at the pennant races, that this wasn't the case. So I wanted to figure out just what impact Casey had.
Now, why now, though, with the Casey Stengel? It's 2005, Casey hasn't managed in almost 40 years. What makes this story relevant today?
Well, first of all, I think he's an evergreen topic. He's a personality that transcended baseball, who is part of the culture. You can find Casey mentioned in Bartlett's Familiar Quotations. He has an entry there. He has a statue in the National Portrait Gallery of Great Americans in Washington, D.C. He testified, he's in the annals of Congress, having been called to Capitol Hill to testify, and that's one of the more reprinted documents in baseball history.
Oh, yeah, that's a great one.
And also, I mean, tactically, he was so far ahead of the curve that he, he's still relevant because there are a number of managers out there who would still benefit from figuring out how he did why he was so successful.
Okay. Okay, good. We'll get to some of that here in a moment. I want to get a little bit more background here as to, how you came to this project. I know you told me that you started writing Forging Genius several years ago. What stopped you and what brought you back to the project?
I never really stopped. I never lost interest in it. But at the time, when I tried to get it published, the funny thing was that people would say, "Casey Stengel, I don't think he's that interesting. Does anybody still know who Casey Stengel is?" And so it got shopped around for a while, and there was very limited interest. So I shelved it for a while, but periodically I would pull it down and I'd dust it off and find things to add to it and things to fix. And finally, it was very strange. Suddenly, more recently, people just started coming out of the woodwork saying, "What? You have a Casey Stengel book? That's so cool. Can I publish your Casey Stengel book?" And as a result, I actually rewrote pretty much the whole book, hopefully to conform with my now matured and experienced writing style, just before publication. It's a brand new book, really, with tons of new research.
Okay. Let's talk about that research. I mean, you're not old enough to have seen Stengel manage, so, how do you get around that? Were you able to go to pore over his career game by game?
I did, in fact. I spent thousands of hours in newspaper archives, going through old box scores. RetroSheet, which is such a boon to all of us who do this kind of research, hasn't gotten back
right to
most of Casey's Yankees career. They just got back to 1960,
right, which
was his last year with the Yankees, which unfortunately comes both after the book and isn't that relevant to the period of his life discussed in the book. So I had to go through and construct a lot of that, a lot of how he did his platooning myself. And then there was, fortunately, a lot of anecdotal material because Casey was in the game for so long and always such a topic of interest that there were literally dozens of players who talked about how he used them, whether they liked it or didn't like it, whether they felt that they learned something from him or whether they felt like he was overrated. And of course, he loved to talk about platooning. Platooning was probably his favorite topic in the world. So he constantly was giving out examples of how he used players. And Casey was one of the more quotable guys in baseball history. There was always room for a interview with Casey Stengel, so there was a lot to choose from in terms of sort of his improvised autobiography that he gave out day by day to the press in terms of how his tactics worked and what his intentions were.
Okay, good. Now, you yourself got to interview some of those former Yankee players for original interviews in the book. Talk to me about that. Who were the most helpful ones to you, and who were the most fun to talk to?
Well, the guys I really enjoyed talking to, in terms of pure friendliness and affability. Jerry Coleman, who just went into the Hall of Fame as a broadcaster for the Padres and, of course, was a rookie on the 1949 Yankees, Stengel's first Yankees team, was very friendly, made time for me to visit with him and conduct a long interview, and was just incredibly supportive in that sense, and helped me understand in a way that few of the other people I talked to or read about understand the nuances of Stengel's personality. The thing is, if you talk to, and these were two guys who were great to talk to also, Ryan Duren, who was Stengel's closer in the late 50s, and Hank Bauer, who was with the Yankees through almost all of Stengel's run up through 1959 when he finally just couldn't play anymore. They will tell you things about Stengel that sometimes sound selfish or, you know, not helpful, and then they'll turn around and say things about him that were so effortlessly generous. And there's a sort of dissonance that results from that. Well, which was the real guy? And Coleman was one of those who helped me understand sort of part of Stengel's conflict as a manager was finding different ways to motivate people. He tried to be a psychologist and used different techniques at different times to help people, but his basic instinct was to be friendly and generous, but at the same time he understood, and this is the education that his career provided him that is so much a topic of my book, that you had to, as Joe McCarthy said, be prepared to cut, you know, your own brother if it was going to help make the team better. So there was a part of Casey that held back from players. In a few instances, of course, some of them, you know, worked their way into his heart like Billy Martin did. But on the whole, he felt that he had to be a little bit reserved.
Right. So did you get to talk to Yogi Berra?
I did, briefly. Yogi doesn't make himself that available anymore. But yeah, we did talk.
What sticks out as far as what he had to say as being particularly relevant to the book?
Gratitude. I mean, I think he said that he owed Stengel a lot and that his career wouldn't have happened the way it did without Stengel. Beyond that, I think that he didn't say much, and I think that their relationship was one that could be a little bit tempestuous, even though Stengel was very supportive of him and pretty much gave him credit, gave Yogi credit for the whole dynasty. I mean, Stengel said, the secret to my success is I never play a game without my man, and by that he meant Yogi. And Yogi was so head and shoulders above just every other catcher in the American League
right. That
he was this huge, huge advantage for the Yankees, and Stengel understood that. And again, part of Stengel's mandate also when coming to the Yankees in 1949 was to make Yogi a catcher because the previous manager, Bucky Harris, couldn't quite bring himself to do it. Yogi was too, you know, didn't throw well enough to be a good catcher and was just too weird to be a good catcher. And Stengel knew that he would be a decisive advantage as a catcher and help make that happen. But, you know, it's like a story Ryan Duren told me, and this really gets to the heart of how Casey motivated people and maybe also says something about Stengel's and Berra's relationship. There was a game where they got into some kind of disagreement about how Berra called the game. And in the clubhouse after the game, Stengel came in and the two started going at it. And you know, I'll spare your listeners the profanity involved, but there was just a lot of it going back and forth. And Berra was, you know, like, you know what, Casey, you know, screw you. And Casey said, no, screw you. It had to be very harsh. And they went back and forth like this with growing intensity. I mean, it seemed like a real argument. Everybody's really angry. And then the fight ended, and Stengel stalks off. But as he's leaving the clubhouse, he catches Duren's eye and winks and smiles as if to say, hey, I was just acting. And you know what? He probably was.
That's funny.
He just felt that's what he needed to do with Yogi at that time.
That's interesting. You know, reading the book, I kind of found, you know, when I think about Berra and Stengel, that they both had a lot in common in that they have, you know, a lot of funny styles to what they would say, almost, you know, obfuscating the meat behind what they had to say, but there was a lot of substance below the surface and a tremendous deal of baseball acumen. To me, there's a very striking parallel there.
AC used to say, people say he's funny, but I don't see anything funny about him.
Right.
He lives in a mansion and he plays golf with millionaires.
Right.
You know, and he was right.
Right.
He was absolutely right.
Right. Well, I think that's the thing. I think you really getting to the meat of the topic of the book. You know, I think the key is that you really try to dispel this notion that Stengel was simply a clown, you know, who kept bumbling through his managerial career until he lucked into the Yankee job. His personality, obviously, you've said a little bit about how he used it with regards to the players, but talk about talk a little bit more about like how he used it with the media as well, because I think that's a real key to his style.
Casey understood something very, very well, and it's less important for today's managers, perhaps. At that time, when he started managing, radio was just coming in. When he managed it, you know, he started managing Brooklyn in 1934. That was his first major league managing job. It was still 5 years before Larry McPhail would come in and break the New York clubs agreement. All three New York clubs had agreed not to broadcast home games. So Red Barber was still way in the future. There wasn't regular radio for the New York fans. Television, of course, had been developed, but it certainly wasn't going to have a big impact on the game for any number of years. And in fact, the first television contracts that baseball had were not particularly lucrative. I mean, for the first TV contract that baseball got for a game of the week, George Steinbrenner wouldn't bend over to pick it up if he found it on the side of the small. So how did a ball club make money? Well, it was all attendance. And when Casey had, first of all, I mean, Casey, look, he was naturally an irrepressible, funny guy, liked to make people laugh, had an expressive face, liked to do pantomimes and impressions. You know, he was known, if you asked him, how did Ty Cobb run the bases, and you happened to be inside, he would still slide across the room, you know, to show you how it happened. Like, there was nothing that was really beyond him in terms of acting out. But this was actually an advantage to him, because off the field, he could engage the media. He could keep the writers, and the media and the writers are interchangeable terms as far as we're concerned.
Right.
For this time period, he could keep them talking about the team. And more important than that, think of it this way. I mean, you know, for example, in 1934, he had a young shortstop named Lonnie Frye. Lonnie Frye made well over 40 errors or 50 errors. I forget the exact number. If the writers were talking about Stengel and the things he said, they weren't talking about how bad Lonnie Frye was. They weren't talking about the fact that the team had no outfielder, that there were no pitchers, you know, that the ownership in general had let the team down, for example. They were having a good time, not a bad time. And it was kind of like getting positive movie reviews so people would come to see your movie. You keep people interested, and you take the heat off the players. And it happened that Stengel enjoyed doing that anyway. So I think that was a big part of things. Now, later on, with the Yankees, still did it, and he also, and this is probably the primary objection that his later younger players had about him, was that he would occasionally rip players in the press, or sometimes frequently. I mean, he would also praise players in the press, obviously. That became frowned upon, and I'd say that was, again, a vestige of just how long he had been in the game, because this was a motivational tool when Stengel began managing.
Okay. Now, getting back to a little bit about Stengel's playing career, he played under John McGraw with the Giants, and you make a pretty big point about how Stengel was successful because McGraw platooned him. This was towards the end of his career, and then Stengel himself later became very reliant on platooning. Was the line between the two of them and platooning really that direct, or were there other managers who used platooning in the interim?
Platooning pre-existed, Casey, and there were always managers who played around with it a little bit. And McGraw might not have been the first one to platoon Casey, you know, a little bit anyway. I mean, it's hard to reconstruct at this stage every day of Casey's playing career in the dead ball era, but it certainly seems like he was probably benched against the odd lefty even back then. But yes, he did. McGraw's platooning made a huge impression on him because the combination of McGraw and the lively ball, which both came into his life in the early 20s, made him more of an impact player than he'd ever been. He'd always been just sort of a decent, serviceable right fielder, occasional center fielder, who could, you know, hit for a decent average and had a little pop in his bat. But suddenly, he's hitting 360. And so, yes, obviously that made an impression on him. And it also helped him to understand what it was like to be platooned, because he didn't like it any better than any of the players he had later did.
Uh-huh.
And this was the key. I mean, the reason that platooning sort of disappeared between McGraw and when Casey came to prominence is that, first of all, it was a pain in the neck for the managers because you had to convince the players of it. It brought you in for a lot of bitching. Even today, nobody likes to be a part-time player. Nobody likes to have the label of, I can't hit lefties or I can't hit righties. And the second part was the statistical evidence just wasn't there to support it. And in the book, I talk about how Casey's general manager at Brooklyn in 1934, Bob Quinn, dismisses platooning as quote, a psychological fad. I mean, he didn't see the stats because no one was collecting them at the time. Stengel having had the experience with McGraw, having watched a lot of ball games, and unlike a lot of outfielders, you know, there are a few outfielders who have become great managers, and maybe it's because they're not as engaged with the game as a catcher or a middle infielder is. You know, they're just sort of out there like Manny Ramirez gazing at the stars. In his case, he really watched and really absorbed a lot of what was going on, and he was able to mentally say, you know, I note that all these lefties I'm seeing, they're having real trouble when that lefty screwball guy comes in. If I ever manage, I'm going to keep them out of the game. He revived it. Now, I mean, the thing is that platooning, as Casey envisioned it, was much more complicated and made much more sense than anything that had been practiced before and anything that has been practiced since.
Okay, elaborate on that. I know you said he went beyond simple, like, lefty-righty platoons. He had a lot of different ways of deploying his players.
He platooned in multiple dimensions. He platooned players at different positions. He made sure that he had guys who could play the outfield and the infield, so he could platoon sort of three guys with one everyday player bouncing between two positions, say second and third, and another one coming in to take over for the third player against certain kinds of pitchers. But at the same time, he also platooned for the kinds of pitchers that were in the game. And one of the things that is really amazing is he wasn't reflexive about it. It wasn't this automatic thing that he had to do. I think if you watch managers, most managers don't like to think. They like to foreclose as many options ahead of the game, before the game, as they can. For one thing, that way they can't be second-guessed. And for another, it's hard to think under pressure. So you structure your team very tightly, and you say, you know, with your pitching staff, this guy has role X, and this guy has
right.
role Y.
This is my 7th-inning guy. This is my 8th-inning guy.
Right, and this is going to be my pinch hitter against righties, and this is going to be my pinch hitter against lefties. And there's no deviation from that. It's all a very automatic procedure.
Right.
And there is something to be said for that, but it gets you into situations where a little bit of being a thoughtful, reflective person will find that you can get a bigger advantage. Casey would say, look, what if I have a left-handed batter in the game and the other guy brings in a left-handed pitcher? Should I go for my right-hander, my right-handed batter? Sure, I probably should. But what if the lefty they're bringing in throws an overhand curveball? And my right-handed batter can't hit an overhand curveball. But in fact, the left-handed guy I have in there can hit an overhand curveball pretty well. Well, what percentage is there in my making the switch at that point? So you let the lefty face the lefty in that instance. You know, he thought about more concerns. I mean, at that point, he's platooning on kinds of pitches beyond lefty-righty. And again, you know, if necessary in making these switches, you have to bring in Mickey Mantle to play shortstop, you do it.
Uh-huh. So, okay. The point that you make often is that Stengel, you know, tried platooning to get the most out of his roster, particularly early on when he had so many weaknesses, you know, to try to cover up with his teams. What were some of his other innovations that he used in terms of deploying his players?
Well, I think that the key to understanding Casey and the importance of those early teams that he managed was that although Casey was probably not aware of the term replacement level as we understand it, he understood what it was. And because he had these teams with very short rosters, because we're talking about teams that were in the middle of the Depression, and they had cut the playing roster not from 25 to 23, just so they didn't have to pay an additional two salaries. That's how bad it was. And he had teams that had no minor league resources and often had injuries and things like that. So he was playing with far less than 23 players a lot of the time. And he understood that watching these teams, that when you have to go to whatever his equivalent of Enrique Wilson was, to use a player who's a favorite of both of ours,
right.
You're killing yourself.
Right.
Because baseball is to a certain extent, and I've written this often, is really kind of that sandlot contest of my first baseman is better than your first baseman, and my catcher is better than your catcher. And all that really means is, on any given day, if you bring to your game Lou Gehrig and I bring Doug Minkiewicz, there are days that Doug Minkiewicz is going to out-homer Lou Gehrig, but they're going to be few and far between. Most of the time, you're going to beat my brains in.
Right.
You're going to, out-homer me if we played 1,000 games. You're going to out-homer me 450-6. And Casey understood that you couldn't get into that position, that as a manager, you should do everything that you can to avoid having to play. You know, I don't want to kick Doug Minkiewicz because he's actually a little better than that most of the time, but Enrique Wilson. And if it means having, as I said before, Mickey Mantle come in and play shortstop so you don't have to play he'll out homer, you know, Lou Aparicio, who the other guy is bringing in. And so he said, when he got to New York, he said, I made up my mind to have two Yankees for every position, and on this team I could do it. And that was the value of Casey. That, I mean, the thing that he had learned was he understood the value of depth, and he wanted to exploit it. There are a lot of managers in history, most recently, for example, Cito Gaston, who won two World Series with the Blue Jays. One of the reasons that people always wonder why Cito hasn't been reemployed since then, one of the reasons was that he didn't understand the value of depth. And when his starting lineup wasn't working, he couldn't do anything to fix it, because he, in spring training, anointed eight guys to play every day and forgot about the rest of the roster. Ralph Houk, who took over for Casey, was exactly the same way. Eight guys could count on playing, and unless somebody got hit by a truck, the other guys were basically casual observers. They were guys who had really good tickets for the rest of the year. They had the best view of the field, but they weren't going to get into a game. And Casey said, the reason these guys don't board here, they give us these players so managers can play with them. And that meant making sure that, you know, if Bobby Brown couldn't play third base that day, then you move Gil McDougald over there. You know, in an emergency, let's put Yogi Berra at catcher so I can get Austin Howard into the game. Or, well, actually, that wouldn't be that year, but you know, he could get his Charlie Silvera or whatever into the game. That way you don't scrape the replacement level.
Right.
Other innovations, well, pinch hitting in the first inning if you have to. Again, if some situation has changed, never wait till later. He didn't say this. Leo DeRocher said, never save a pitcher for tomorrow. Tomorrow it might rain, but Casey understood that very well. So you go to your bullpen, which managers were reluctant to do at that time. And I'm talking about going back to the 30s. You use your bullpen, you use your bench early and often, and you just take every opportunity you can to win a game. And don't assume, oh, well, we'll come back in the seventh. I should save my best pinch hitter for the eighth inning. Those kinds of things. No, you get it early and you get it often.
Okay. Yeah, it seems to me, especially with regards to the bullpen usage, that he was really pretty far ahead of the curve in terms of anointing a relief ace and using that relief ace almost in preference to some of his starters. Was it Joe Page? Was that his main guy for the Yankees?
Yes, and to be fair, he had the advantage of Bucky Harris having used Joe Page in that role in 1947.
Okay.
So, and this is part of what got Bucky Harris was Casey's immediate predecessor, and part of what got Bucky Harris fired was he used Joe Page in this really wonderful, wonderful way as a fireman. I don't want to say as a closer because it's not the same thing.
Right.
Bringing him in tie games, bringing him in also to close in the traditional sense, and they won the World Series. The next year, Joe Page was a guy who liked to party and couldn't really keep himself conditioned for more than a year at a time. So Harris, he was undisciplined. Harris didn't discipline him, and the Yankees just missed making the playoffs. And because Page had this poor year, that was perceived to be the letdown. So Casey, at least, had a model of how to use Page. But the thing is, like, what he didn't do, I mean, here's again an interesting thing, because we talk about the value of closers all the time and how much a team should pay for them. Are closers something you should draft out of college? Are they made, or do you find them? And Casey was definitely in the you-can-make-a-closer school. And after Page was toast in 1950, and they traded for a guy named Tom Farrick, who became the new closer, and then Johnny Sain was the closer for a while, Ryan Duren was the closer for a while. Like, Casey moved people in and out of the role. He clearly did not believe in the closer mystique or the aura. He was a bullpen by committee guy, and, you know, whoever was the hot hand, that was the guy who was going to be his relief ace for that year. And another thing he understood, which I find really fascinating because it's true, and I don't know why it's true, but it is. He told Sparky Anderson, when Casey was quite an old man, he said, son, if you have two good relief pitchers, get another one, because as sure as you're standing there, next year one of those two is going to go bad.
Yeah, we see that all the time right now, particularly with this current crop of Yankees, with Tom Gordon and now Tanyan Sturts falling apart.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.